Welcome to Gin and Topic. We have tasted the gin and now we get on to our topic. Hey, Anya.
Hello, Sarah. It's Friday and we're about to learn something and drink some gin.
We are. What could get better than that?
Honestly, I don't know because we've been doing this for 6 series, so clearly we enjoy it.
And hopefully others do too. So, drink and let's learn.
Let's learn. See you in a minute.
This week, we are talking to Jeremy Howard.
Okay, brilliant.
All the way from Midwest America.
Ooh.
I know.
International.
International. He is a PhD student at the University of Missouri, St. Louis in the US.
Love that. Brilliant.
And whilst he's currently studying bumblebees, because
we've done bees.
Hamish on with bees.
Lovely
in
Hamish.
One. And really, we can't top that episode by talking about bees again because it was awesome. And if you haven't listened to it, listen.
It was a great episode.
So much about bees.
It's one that I actually retained some information from.
I know. Really good. So we're not going to talk bumblebees with him, although we might do a little bit. But his previous work was on flying squirrels.
Of course.
Well, they're a bit like a bumblebee, aren't they?
They both fly.
They've got wings. Yeah, ish. So we might talk about how we got from bumblebees to flying squirrels, but we're going to talk about flying squirrels today.
Sounds good.
And because, you know, they deserve some airtime.
Oh, I knew it was coming from the face and it was painful.
Yeah, it was, wasn't it? But I thought it had to be done. So we're giving flying squirrels some airtime in this episode as we talk all about flying squirrels with Jeremy. And our question is, why should we research and protect flying squirrels?
Ooh, interesting.
Well, absolutely. Because I was just like, oh, yeah, they're quite cute. Quite like talking about flying squirrels, but I wouldn't know why you'd research them. And I wouldn't know why we'd want to protect them. I didn't even realise that they were on the sort of, I don't know if they're on the list to be protected or just of interest. They're just sort of there.
They're just sort of there.
So we're going to talk flying squirrels. We're going to drink tonics. I've got a little cheeky gin by the side to add to my tonic. Yeah, might add a little bit more later because we've got 3 tonics to get through. So,
and it would be a shame to waste any of them.
Oh, dear.
Yeah.
So we will drink tonic, we will drink gin, we will drink flying squirrels. No, we won't. We'll talk.
We won't drink flying squirrels.
Jeremy, welcome to Gin and Topic.
We have tasted
your tonics, which means we get onto your topic and hopefully don't burp our whole way through all of these conversations.
And if you haven't listened to The Tasting Room, that's going to sound like a really weird comment, but trust us.
Absolutely. So, listen to that because we've got 3 tonics to get through. You need to know which one's going to be good for you. I'm going to mix mine with some gin. For this conversation. Anya, you're ahead of the game.
I did it sneakily. I sneakily did a little one there.
Well done.
Thank you.
And Jeremy, for this bit, we've welcomed you in and then we say, kick back, put your feet up, drink more of the tonic, keep your burps to yourself. And Anya and I will lay our cards on the table as to how much we know about your topic. Mm-hmm. And then you can fill in with any of the little gaps.
Yeah, because there are always tiny, tiny, tiny gaps. You know, we've always got loads of knowledge. I actually, for once, have something here, Sarah.
Okay, so we are talking flying squirrels.
Yes.
And what have you got?
Well, I was asked earlier, what's your topic today? And I said, flying squirrels, to my friend. She is Australian. And she looked at me and said something I'd never heard before. Do you mean sugar gliders? And I was like, yeah, what? Is that the same
sugar
thing?
Sugar gliders.
Sugar gliders or flying fox. And so I don't know if those are the same things, but that's what I've got to bring to the table today as possible other names.
Nice. Okay. Okay.
Well, and that's all my knowledge, and that's all I've got.
We'll let Jeremy relax a little bit more, but I love a sugar glider. I feel like that should be something that could go with the gin and tonic easily. A little sugar glider on the side, although maybe, maybe not.
Sounds like a chaser.
Yeah, it does, doesn't it? So, flying squirrels, what do we know? They're squirrels with bat wings that glide. I know that. Mm-hmm. They don't actually fly. And we were saying that Jeremy's other area of study is bumblebees. But we can't talk a huge amount, although we'll definitely talk some about bumblebees because, you know, there might be some new stuff since we talked to Hamish.
And everyone loves bees.
But unlike bees with wings, flying squirrels just have everything connected with a bat suit with web, don't they? Just like base jumping sort of suit that they're wearing.
Suit.
Which came from flying squirrels, didn't it? The idea of a base jumping suit came from watching flying squirrels and how they glide.
I love the random stuff we're bringing to the table here. This is brilliant.
Yeah.
Excellent
so
knowledge.
So why should we research them? Because then you get ideas for base jumping suits.
Good.
Yeah, there you
Excellent.
Go.
I think that's a worthy cause. Why should we research flying squirrels and why should we protect them? They're quite cool.
And I'm imagining, didn't all the grey squirrels attack the red squirrels? Maybe some other squirrels attacked other squirrels. Then now the flying squirrels are in danger from other squirrels. There's a lot of the word there.
And are flying squirrels actually squirrels then? Are they a relation of the squirrel, or are they like flying fox, like actually they're called a squirrel but they're not really a squirrel? I don't know. Got too many questions now.
And actually there is something else that's just occurred to me.
Yeah,
we say squirrel, Americans say it differently, right? Because there was a whole thing on Queer Eye about them saying squirrel and taking the mick out of how Tan said squirrel, and now I'm self-conscious of the way I'm saying it.
Jeremy,
like with the accent.
Say squirrel?
I say squirrel.
That's, okay, no, that sounds good to me. Yeah,
that
good.
That sounds fine. That's a squirrel. Yeah,
that's fine. And there's no judgment if you pronounce it differently. We still get the idea across.
Yeah. And you can't say it loudly in our house because otherwise the dog goes bonkers and looks up a tree trying to find it.
Yeah.
So what have we got? Knowledge? Nothing. Flying squirrels, they're cute. Why should we research them? Why should we protect them? I'm not sure because I'm just like, do they just, have they got anything to give us? I don't know. I think they have to earn my desire to keep them. I'm like, yeah, they might be a bit cute.
Okay.
Yeah, but lots of really great questions you brought. And I will try and fill in the gaps and answer as many of them as I can.
Nice.
It has been a few years, I guess, for the audience context. So I live in Missouri right now. I'm doing my PhD on bumblebees, as you all mentioned. Before that, I did my master's across the Mississippi River in Illinois, and I researched flying squirrels there. So I'm a few years removed from it, but flying squirrels have always had my heart. I've told people why I love bumblebees. If you could give me the chance to go back to flying squirrels, I would do so in a heartbeat. So I have a very soft spot for them. They're very cute. They're very cool. And not a lot of people know about them. So I think one of the questions that was thrown out earlier was, how do they kind of relate to other types of squirrels? So they are squirrels. The flying fox and the sugar glider thing, I'll get to in a second. Those are similar, but separate.
Ooh. Okay, so they're definitely a squirrel, but with their limbs connected.
Yeah, they're definitely squirrels. There's kind of like three categories more or less about squirrels. You have like your ground squirrels. So like they live in like burrows, like in the ground, like the name would suggest. So think of like your groundhogs or like your prairie dogs.
Which are things that we don't have in the UK at all.
Oh, right. Because I'm in America. So what lives over here might not live over there.
And so Groundhog, I'm thinking Groundhog Day, the film, isn't it?
Yeah.
And that was a thing that could tell the future, wasn't it? Or something, or when spring was going to be over or something. But they're like little big rat type creatures, are they? I don't know. What's a groundhog look like?
They're like really husky rats is the easiest way to describe it.
Oh, I'm not sure about those.
But they're more cute than rats is the other thing I will say. So they're not quite as...
Okay.
Generally, rats are kind of repulsive to people. I wouldn't say they're repulsive.
Yeah. Okay.
But you have your ground squirrels. You have your tree squirrels, which most people are pretty familiar with, like your gray squirrels, your red squirrels, the ones that like scamper across your yard and, you know, climb up the tree and all that. And then you have your flying squirrels. A lot of people I talk to kind of confuse the trees and the flying ones. They're like, oh yeah, I see them across my yard. You probably don't for a couple of reasons. The first is that flying squirrels are nocturnal. So they only come out at night. You're not going to see them during the day unless you were, you know, doing some kind of research on them and you captured one and then had it during the day. But yeah, they're only out at night. And then they don't really like to come down from the trees very much. So they're very, very dependent on our forests in the United States for the species we have here, as well as in Europe. You guys have the Siberian flying squirrel, which is not in the United Kingdom, but it's across like Eastern Europe, Russia into East Asia. But yeah, very reliant on your trees and all of that for all of their needs. They typically eat like seeds and nuts and lichen. And they're really big dispersers. So like plants reproduce by scattering their seeds everywhere.
Yeah.
And the squirrels kind of help to move things around the forest for reproduction. So the forest can kind of keep existing. They're also, on the other hand, this is kind of like a kind of grisly, but like a fact of life, is their primary prey. Their primary prey for owls. So if you have like a really healthy squirrel population or flying squirrel population, you have a healthy owl population. So you kind of need those to be in place so the owls can also exist.
Yeah.
And so... So they come out at night, and obviously owls do too. I'm imagining like an air fight of owls trying to catch flying squirrels. Is that what happens?
They don't. I don't know. We say flight or fight.
Air fight, as in, do they catch them on the wings?
Sarah's imagining some kung fu fighting going on. Yeah,
that's sort of where my mind went at first. I just wanted to clarify that. So it's more of a cat and mouse scenario where the owl is a bird of prey. It's going to go after the rodent, which is the flying squirrel. The flying squirrel mostly is going to rely on its small size. So they're about like a third of the size of the tree squirrels you kind of see in your yard. Okay. So they're much smaller.
So in comparison to a human hand, how big are we talking?
I would say the flying squirrel would fit in your palm.
They're so tiny and cute.
Yeah, they're real small.
So I was thinking of them being like the size of a normal squirrel, but with wings or with limbs connected. And so that's like almost the size of an owl. But these are tiny, fitting in the palm of your hand.
They are very small. Yeah. Wow. Very tiny. There's a couple of exceptions. Like there's like the Japanese giant flying squirrel, which as you can imagine is a very large flying squirrel. That's more like the size of an owl, but most of them are pretty small.
So crazy. Very cool. So cute.
Yeah, they are very cute.
And so do we know how they evolved, unlike squirrels, to have basically bat wing type connected of all their limbs?
Yeah, so I'm not admittedly like the biggest evolution expert, but the idea being that at some point in the evolutionary history of the world, we had a branching point between the squirrel ancestors, which became sort of the tree squirrels and the ground squirrels and the flying squirrels. And the squirrels that were basically adapted really well to the forest had those features and, you know, reproduced and eventually formed their own species. So they're more adapted to live in those forests overall. Yeah, they are separate species.
And so what did you study then when you were studying them? What were you looking at?
Yeah, so I am really interested as a biology person in spatial behavior. So like how does stuff move around? Like how do animals move around? Where do they go? What kind of impacts that? Because a lot of times we as humans, like we have our smartphones and we can use Google Maps to get everywhere when we don't know where we're going. Animals don't have smartphones, so they have to rely on lots of other things like landmarks, or if they have certain abilities like really good sense of smell, or if they can use the sun's position in the sky to navigate. These are all kind of like aspects of nature they can use to move around. I was initially getting interested in that kind of research. And what I mostly looked at with flying squirrels is just, where do they go? So what I did was I put these things called radio collars on them, which is basically like a little necklace that has like a bulb that gives off like a radio signal. And I tracked them in the woods at night, kind of see where they went in Illinois.
Wow. And so are the owls the main threat to them?
In terms of like immediately, Yes, in terms of like a biology threat, yeah. I would say in terms of broader aspect that humans and deforestation is probably the bigger threat.
I was going to ask, because the minute you say they live in a forest, I'm like, oh dear, we're probably causing them some issues.
Yes, we are. Oh, like many things, as we do.
yeah, humans are great at that. But the minute you see a tiny, cute animal, you don't want to do it anymore. Hopefully.
Yeah, they just help. They just help.
Mm-hmm. So why should we be researching them? You know, why? What do we learn about where they go and how they move and tracking around that spatial sort of navigation that they have?
Yeah, so since flying squirrels, you know, you need the forest, like I mentioned, to move around and everything. And we kind of, you know, been cutting down a lot of trees, deforestation. We have a lot much more urban area than we used to, you know, many, many decades ago. So it's harder for animals to move around, particularly flying squirrels, to get the resources that they need. And by understanding kind of the spatial patterns, like where they go, where they're limited in moving, all that stuff, we can kind of better manage our land. So mm-hmm. we can, you know, keep certain parts of the forest that need to be around so they can, you know, live, or we can, you know, make connecting pieces between areas of forest so they can move from one area to another to get resources that they need. So a big part of, or what I've learned from my master's is all about things like wildlife management and how we manage, you know, the lands we have and how we can sort of preserve certain things, but also maybe connect things better. Mm-hmm. So one really cool thing, and this ties back into the thing you asked about the sugar gliders in Australia, they do to connect land better is they basically build these giant poles with platforms on each side of like a highway to connect two pieces of forest. So like a glider can like jump off, glide over the other pole and land, and then go the forest part where they weren't.
It's like an adventure trail for them.
yeah. It's very cool. There's lots of research in Australia on that stuff. And that's one of the ways you can kind of mitigate urbanization, habitat degradation by humans is kind of connect the land. So if we have better ideas of where animals are, specifically where flying squirrels go, we can, you know, better, you know, take care of the land.
And so flying squirrels don't fly, they glide. But how far can they glide?
So that depends.
So over a highway?
They could potentially over a highway. So there's lots of textbook answers of like, they can go this far. I guess the best answer I have is it depends on how high the thing they're jumping from is. So as you mentioned, flying squirrels glide. The flying is kind of a misnomer. They can't actually just like jump off the ground and start flying away. They have to be on top of something and jump off of it. And what they have is this thing in physics called a glide ratio. So what that means is basically for every certain amount of X distance, like going horizontally, they can move that much distance per 1 meter of drop. Mm-hmm. So for example, if a flying squirrel had a glide ratio of 2 to 1, it could move 2 meters across before it drops 1 meter. Mm-hmm. The reason that math stuff is important is that influences how high the structures we need to build so they can get across gaps. Mm. So like if you build a pole that's too short, like in the Australia example, and the squirrel glides and it doesn't make it across and lands on the highway and then gets ran over by a truck, that's not helpful. Important where we need the math to actually align with the conservation, you know, implications and efforts.
And that's what your maths teacher should be telling you when you're doing these things, because I would have cared so much more if my teacher was like, this could save this cute little animal from being splattered on a highway.
Yeah. And also I'm thinking that they have to start on the higher pole and they land on the lower pole. So on a highway, do you have to have two sets? Because they obviously want to go one way and then come back the other way. They can't always just go one way across the highway.
Yeah, it's not very productive if they can go one way then never come back. It has to work both ways.
So two sets of poles, higher, lower. Yeah.
But you said that the sugar gliders are different from flying squirrels.
Oh, yeah. So this is one piece of evolution I do understand a little bit better. There's this concept in biology called convergent evolution. Basically what that means is think of like organism A and organism B. They are very similar, or they look very similar in terms of like attributes or the types of environments they live in. Take like sharks and dolphins. So like they're kind of similar. They're like two body shape. They have the fins kind of in the rough area. But we know dolphins are mammals. We know that sharks are not mammals. They're, I think they're chondrichthyes, which is like a type of, I forget what the type of fish is, but they're more related to like skates and stingrays and stuff like that. But the reason that they are kind of similar is they're in environments that produce similar evolutionary pressures to get them adapt a similar way. So with the sugar gliders in Australia, those glide and those climb up trees just like flying squirrels, but those are not actually related evolutionarily to flying squirrels. So they're marsupials, and then flying squirrels are, you know, Scirridaes, they're squirrels. So they look similar and they have similar like anatomy and physiology and stuff, but they're actually separate evolution-wise.
Nice.
But yeah. We wouldn't be able to tell them apart. If we looked at them flying, we'd be like, oh, it's a flying squirrel. Because you kind of, as you said, if they look the same, you kind of think that they are similar, but they're not.
Yeah, it depends on the species. So sugar gliders are distinct enough looking from flying squirrels, pretty much any of the species, that you could probably tell them apart. This gets more complicated when you have things like species that look very similar, like, and not even just with like general body shape. I'm talking like color and pattern, like insects or something like that, where like it's really, really hard to tell these apart. Since I've been studying insects, I've learned insects are so complex and there's just so many little nuances that are really hard to tell things apart.
Yeah, it's like
mammals are a little easier.
This area for my PhD has suddenly become really hard. Let me go back to flying squirrels.
All those little niche things.
Yes.
So what forest were you looking at with the flying squirrels?
So there were two sites I had. On the campus I was at, which is Southern Illinois University, Edwardsville, they have actually a couple forest patches on campus, which is really cool. Oh, like nice. A lot of college campuses don't have that, but we're in rural Illinois, so it still exists. So I looked for some there, and then there was a professor who owned a bunch of private, like, forested farmland about 10 miles north of campus, so I was able to utilize that really well.
Wow. That's one of those lucky little niche things where you're like, oh, you just so happen to own a forest.
Yes, I was very fortunate, because the flying squirrel population on the campus was not very high. It was very low, so I was struggling to find them to get data for my research. And then I went to this farmland, I was like, oh, they're everywhere. There's so many of them.
Well, and that leads me on then. What is the population for flying squirrels like around the world? And we were talking about, you know, why should we research them? Why should we protect them? Is that declining?
Yeah. So I guess to get to the first part, in terms of population, it kind of depends on the area. So flying squirrels can be pretty hardy. I guess I should also say, when I'm talking about this, my perspective is from the North American side. I can't really speak to like Europe and other parts of the world. But for the United States, I would say they're pretty hardy if there is forest around. Obviously, when you're more natural areas like out west, when there's a little bit more forest and mountains and stuff, their population numbers are much better, particularly when you have forests that are older. So like if it's been around for a long time, you have old decaying trees are a great habitat for flying squirrels, by the way. People think they're really ugly and gross and just cut down the old dying trees, but they're vital habitat for them.
How come?
Because they have like little cavities that kind of, when the trees kind of decay, like cavities form, and those cavities act as like little pieces of shelter for them. They can also help with like woodpeckers and other squirrels too. But in general, old decaying trees are actually very valuable.
We love an old decaying tree here. Yes, they matter. All trees matter.
They do. But obviously where you have less development, there's higher numbers versus where you have, you know, more urban development. But flying squirrels have been pretty persistent as long as you can maintain, you know, decent habitat and connectivity. That's usually helpful. Like something I found out during my master's research was that there's actually a flying squirrel population in Central Park in New York City, which blew my mind because it's just like a square of green and it's surrounded by concrete. So that blew my mind. So I was like, they exist and they can exist in a lot more places I didn't think.
And when you were researching how they travel, I got a little sidetracked in my brain thinking about there was a program in the UK where they put detectors on cats, and they suddenly found that cats really stray quite far, domestic cats, you know.
And they go off. You watching?
And they, and they end up going like miles and traveling around and everything and going on in weird sort of travel patterns at night, you know, when they're off exploring, and the neighbors are like, where is it? So flying squirrels, do they travel quite far, or like with Central Park, are they quite happy just bouncing from tree to tree, eating what's there and sort of staying quite close by?
Yeah, I would say it's kind of limited by the forest structure they're in. Maybe like a square kilometer or two is what I typically found. It wasn't like crazy, crazy far.
They don't
far.
Go huge distances.
Yeah, they're not migrating like vast distances across forests. But more space is helpful for, you know, maintaining greater numbers, because, you know, you need more land to maintain more individuals. But like in Central Park, I'm sure they're pretty locked in there. Like there's not a lot of places you can go outside of the couple of trees in Central Park.
And how long do they live?
Typically anywhere from like 5 to 8 years. So they're not super, they can't be super, super old. They reproduce, I want to say like after maybe a year or two, they reach sexual maturity. So, and they have two breeding seasons throughout the year. The ones in America do.
Mm. And what's in, how many are in a clutch? Would you call it a clutch
squirrels
like you would with birds? I don't know.
I believe it's a litter, but don't quote me on that. I mean, it's not something I remember entirely.
Brood or litter, yeah, like kittens and puppies.
I want to say anywhere from maybe 5 to 10. Like, it's not huge numbers, but it's a handful.
Yeah. Have you ever seen a baby one?
I have not seen a baby flying squirrel. I've seen what's called a juvenile, which basically means like it has the fur and everything, but it's not like a full-grown adult.
Yeah, cute. Which I'd imagine is when they're cutest. Like,
yeah, they are very cute when they're juveniles.
I know immediately what I'm going to Google the minute we're done. I'm going to be straight on looking at pictures of them.
Yes. But they must be really hard to see looking cute if they only come out at night. Did much of your research just involve knowing that they were there but not really seeing them, apart from when you caught them and popped a little necklace on them?
So all the numbers I got from like their population numbers and where I found them and such were all from trapping them. Mm. Depending on, you know, the forest and... Admittedly, I've never actually seen a flying squirrel like just out in the woods at night. I've always seen them when I've captured them, just because like they could be really high in the tree. And if it's night, it's dark, it's harder to find. But yeah, when I would catch them with like these little metal box traps, which are called Sherman traps, you can use them for any kind of like forest rodent or field mice or anything like that. But yeah, that's how I verified that they were actually there. Otherwise, I wouldn't be able to tell you numbers.
Mm. So what do you lure them with into their box?
So my master's advisor taught me the golden rule. If you want to catch any mammal is peanut butter and oatmeal.
I was going to say peanut butter.
it's basically mammal meth is what he told me. And he is right.
Yeah. Works on the dogs too. Peanut butter every time.
I think it works on humans too. Quite a lot.
Oh, it depends on what kind of peanut butter though, Sarah. If you, if you gave me crunchy, I wouldn't be interested. But if it was smooth peanut butter, I'd go
for
it.
Was there a debate about smooth or crunchy peanut butter? For flying squirrels, or do they not care?
I don't think so. I think we use crunchy. Admittedly, I'm a smooth guy myself, so
all the best people are.
You're wrong. You're both wrong. I like crunchy. Crunchy's good. I'm with you, the flying and the squirrels. Here. Yeah, me and the squirrels. We're there. So what else should we or do in terms of studying them, protecting them? What's the future like for flying squirrels? How are you going to get back to researching flying squirrels after you're done with bumblebees?
Yeah, that last question, I'm not sure how that will go.
Yeah, Sarah's really just grilling you on your career choices here. This is how I feel when I go home. What's your plan, Sonia? I don't know, Sarah.
I would say the big thing with flying squirrels, the important takeaway is that even though we can't always like see them because they're very kind of secretive, they don't always come out, it takes a while to catch them. And, you know, like I mentioned, they're nocturnal. They're very small. They're kind of designed to be, for lack of a better word, squirreled away so they, you know, don't get eaten by owls or found. But the big thing is that it's important to remember that they are this little piece of an ecosystem. So as I mentioned before, they help with like dispersing like seeds and truffles and that kind of stuff throughout the forest for, you know, plant and fungi reproduction. Mm. But they're also, you know, helpful for the owl population. If you were to remove them from the ecosystem, that would probably cause a bunch of collapse with a bunch of other areas because you wouldn't get that reproduction of the plants and fungi. You wouldn't get the food source for the owls and that would cause them to collapse. So even if you can't see them, I think it's important to know that their worth is there in terms of their vital place in the ecosystem. They're like a piece of a puzzle that needs to be in place.
And that's it. You need as many pieces of the puzzle as we possibly can, rather than just thinking, oh, they're a little insignificant piece. It doesn't matter because, as you said, it's all those pieces of the ecosystem. And I love, I've got these wonderful images of them just like dropping little bits of truffle and seeds, but actually it's just poo. It's just poo.
Yeah, they do poop a lot like most rodents.
And so getting back to researching them.
Yeah, back to the future of them, as opposed to their poo.
What do you think? What else could we learn from them? Because this is the thing with a lot of animals. I go, well, have we learned everything? How, you know, what more could we get from studying, from researching those animals?
I think things I'd like to see with flying squirrels more are just kind of like how smart are they, or what are their, you know, cognitive abilities? Because we know that, you know, we know there are things about their life cycle and the habits that they need to survive and everything, but we don't know as much about their abilities to like find stuff or how they solve problems in the environment. So we know like there are lots of smart animals out there.
Yeah, dolphins get all the hype for being smart and I'm bored of it. I want to know about the squirrels.
Yeah, and we do know that tree squirrels are incredibly intelligent and you see people setting up traps, or not traps, but like assault courses in the garden because the squirrel will always get to the bird's nuts that you've got hanging up there. You know, they're incredibly clever. So whether the flying squirrels have that same capability or whether they put all of their intelligence into their bat suit.
Yeah, yeah.
And what you can't see at home is that every time Sarah says bat suit, she lifts her arms up like she's got a little bat suit.
Yes.
And we've done really well at not saying anything, but I can't leave it any longer.
That is an accurate depiction of like when they jump, they basically launch their arms out and like they're it's called a patagium. It's like a wavy membrane that connects their front legs to their hind legs. And like, that's what lets them like, you know, glide. So that's how it works. They jump up and like,
well done, Sarah, you're correct. And so the future of flying squirrels as a whole, does it look positive, even despite these humans coming in and destroying habitats and, you know, being owl food? Are they sort of doing well?
I think it depends on area to area. So I think they're referred to as generalists. So another sort of general bio concept for your listeners, there's what are called generalists and specialists. Specialists have to have a very specific type of environment to survive. So things that like live only in like one island of the world, or like stuff that lives in the equator, like you only find it there because the habitat is so incredibly special that they can't exist anywhere else. Flying squirrels are generalists, so they're a little more hardy. They can kind of live generally anywhere there's forest. But that being said, that doesn't necessarily give us the right to just like destroy everything, because they can potentially live.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the outlook, I want to say it can be good, but it's with the caveat that we take better management, we take better care of our land, we more strategically think about how do our development decisions and our infrastructure influence the environment around us, and how do we sort of more smartly leave that habitat in place or help mitigate, you know, animals moving from point A to point B across our urban areas, across our development, so that they can persist.
Mm.
So that's kind of my answer for that. It's not really like a yes or a no. I think it's just it can be positive, but there needs to be better landscape choices at play.
Mm.
And do those landscape choices cross over into your work that you're doing with bumblebees then? What can we glean from your PhD research at the moment about the bumblebees within those urban areas and how they're moving around?
So I don't have I'm still collecting data, so I don't have like a definitive result. Like, here's what I could show.
You're like,
yet.
No spoilers.
Yeah, don't worry. We won't hold you to it. We won't go, you told us this, you know, you're fine.
But what I hope will come out of it is that we can kind of see areas of the city that are more supportive of bumblebees and areas that are not as supportive. So one weird, I guess, kind of, not caveat, but thing that's weird with bees is you would think that like urban areas, more concrete and everything, there would be less bees there per se. And like, oh, the more rural areas, there would be less bees, but it's not always the case. Sometimes like city areas can have lots of gardens and, you know, artificial plantings and stuff that support like bee populations overall.
Mm.
But the bigger, I guess, question we're looking at is on the genetics level, like how are the bees doing health-wise? So from the hopefully genetic sequence data I get back, we'll kind of find what kind of genes are active, what are not as active, how are they doing in terms of like their genetic health. So one thing with animals is what's called inbreeding. So if your population of animals
they do
is
that
too,
in the royal family too.
Yeah, yes, they do that in the royal family.
you can keep that one in, Ben, I'm not afraid.
But one thing that inbreeding does is when you have low genetic diversity, if you have inbreeding, that leaves whatever your animal is very susceptible to being wiped out to disease or some kind of other like catastrophe. So you always want genetic diversity, and that applies to humans as well. Genetic diversity is actually a very, very good thing for survival.
We're a big fan of it. Like, let's carry on doing that.
That's why we didn't all die from COVID-19, is that we had genetic diversity. Also the vaccine, that was incredibly helpful as well.
Yeah, both of those. And I do have to ask the question that I ask everybody who studies bees. What did you think of the bee movie, and do you think that it has impacted the studying of bees?
I don't think the bee movie is a good biological representation of bees, is what I will say. I guess if it got people interested in bees, that's good, because it's always good to have more people promote insects, because insects can kind of be the less charismatic animals.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think it maybe damaged the brand a little bit in terms of.
I'd agree with that. Yeah.
Especially how we see bees and what people think about them.
Although of the insect world, I think bumblebees are like the poster boys of the insect kingdom. There are many more that I wouldn't want to study.
Yeah, bumblebees are definitely very charismatic. They are often overshadowed by honeybees, though. Mm-hmm. A lot of people think honeybees are like, they do everything and they get all the credit. Bumblebees are actually better pollinators than honeybees. Not to like throw shade at the honeybees. But
throw that shade.
But they are better. However, just because we have honeybees are everywhere, we kind of still do need them for pollination. And they give us the human product of honey that everyone very much likes. So, you know, they still have their place. But I think they get overshadowed. The bumblebees get overshadowed by the honeybees when reality should be the other way around.
Justice for the bumblebees.
Yeah.
Oh, I love a bumblebee.
Yeah.
We put a bumblebee and a flying squirrel in a fight. Who's going to win?
Oh, that's a good question. I'd probably say the flying squirrel, because the flying squirrel could probably eat the bumblebee. Mm. Its mouth is big enough where it could eat it. It probably gets stung, maybe, but yeah. It could eat it.
But do they eat insects or just fruit and nuts and things? So.
It's mostly fruit and nuts. They do eat some insects, but it's mostly a vegetarian diet.
Mm. Like if the insect really annoys them, they'll do it. But
well, I don't know about that. They might just, you know, ignore it and fly
that
away.
Could be your next study research. Like, when will they eat the insects?
And especially if the bumblebee is covered in peanut butter. Well, there you go.
Oh, yeah. It's irresistible.
But then you would want it to be smooth, for sure. Easier to coat the bee in it.
Dip the bee.
Gone down a weird route here.
It has. So in terms of flying squirrels and their amazingness and researching them and protecting them, is there anything else that we should learn that we haven't learned from this conversation to make us then hold up that banner to go, flying squirrels, they're awesome?
I guess just sort of to echo what I had said earlier, just again, knowing that it's an important place in an ecosystem, part of a larger picture overall. Obviously, flying squirrels are very cute, and that's a good selling point for them. It makes people want to preserve them. Same with the bumblebees, that helps as well. But I think it's important to know that it can act as sort of an example of like, hey, even if, or we have this charismatic animal that's, you know, like found this ecosystem, but there also are lots of uncharismatic animals that found their ecosystems as well. So it kind of just act as like, hey, this is a secret. This animal is kind of secret. If you can't see it, it's important. It holds a very important place. There's also lots of other secretive animals that we don't know as much about that aren't as charismatic. So kind of pay attention to the lesser known guys as well.
Yeah. The cuter ones get the press, but the kind of ugly ones matter too.
Right. Something like a blobfish that was at the bottom of the ocean.
Oh,
it's very ugly. Like,
yeah, they're not cute. Bless them.
Yeah. Yeah. But they got to have some important role.
They're still a jigsaw puzzle. There's still a little piece.
Yeah. Yeah. Or like a naked mole rat. You know.
Yeah.
I don't want to be left with the vision of a naked mole rat.
Sorry.
But I have to ask, Jeremy, how did you get into researching flying squirrels in the first place?
Yeah.
So, much like I mentioned, kind of like looking for labs and research questions and stuff. When I got my bachelor's in biology back in 2015, which it's like coming up on a decade, making me a little older. No, it's fine. You got to think about the research journey.
You have those moments when you suddenly go, wow, that was a long time ago.
Yeah, that was a long time ago. I didn't really have any research experience, but I knew I wanted to do some kind of more school to learn more about animal stuff. And I knew I really liked mammals. So at that point once I finished with my bachelor's, I knew I wanted to at least go for like a master's degree. And I wasn't really sold on a PhD because, as they tell you, when you go to grad school for like a doctorate, it can be anywhere from like 5 to 10 years. I think the average for the United States, regardless of your field, is like 7 years.
Yeah.
So like you're signing up for a very long commitment.
Long time.
Mm-hmm. You are also signing up to be poor for a very long time, because students are not moneymakers. It's you're investing in yourself for the future. Mm-hmm. But I knew at that point, back in 2015, I wanted to do a master's, and I was mostly looking around for mammal labs that would do anything like mammal related that I might be interested in. And I didn't really understand the grad school process very well when I first applied, so I didn't get in the first time. And then I like kind of went back to the drawing board, learned how I was supposed to better apply and make me a better looking candidate. And then I was able to get into a program that started mid-year. So typically we start in August and we end in May. But like, I was like, I can't wait a whole another year. I was living in my parents' basement. So I was like, I need to get out. I'm in my early 20s. I want to go see things and do things. So I found the school in Illinois, Southern Illinois University, Edwardsville, and the advisor there, Dr. Richard Esner, was taking people mid-year. And something I'll tell any of your listeners, if you're going to grad school, always meet your prospective advisor so you can kind of feel them out. Because it's like interviewing to have like, who is this person? Will I like them as a potential boss in a way? Yeah. It's like, they're also scoping you out, but you're scoping them out. I did not do this. I just took a leap of faith and he's like, yeah, spot, I'll go. So I drove like 800 miles out to the Midwest and thank God it worked out because he's a really great guy and we gelled very well. But that could have been really bad.
Yeah. But you're like a flying squirrel jumping out the tree. Hopefully.
Yeah. So that's how I ended up in the Midwest. And then from there, I had a good experience in my master's with research and everything. And I wanted to do a PhD after.
Yeah. You were like, oh, screw it. I'll sign on. I'll do it. Yeah.
Sign up for this for a long time.
I'm committed now. See, at one point, Sarah said to me, you could do a PhD. And my dad from the other sofa went, no.
Yeah, I think everyone could potentially do a PhD. It's not really about, everyone thinks it's about like raw, like everyone's like a super genius here. It's not really about that. It's more just about being determined and kind of picking yourself up when things go wrong. Cause you're basically managing a project for, you know, 5 to 7+ years. Mm-hmm. And like, how do you adjust? How do you fix things when they go wrong? Are you willing to learn from your mistakes and learn new skills? So it's kind of more like a test of just how gritty you are in some ways versus just like, are you smart or not? Because I don't feel like I'm that smart. I actually feel like a lot of people are way smarter than me in this program. So.
And I think the hardest thing as well, you get to the end and you've done all your stuff and you've like produced this work and then they go, come on then, defend it.
Yes.
It's like, really? Yeah. I'm burnt out. I've been working so hard and now you want to rip it to pieces and I've got to stand here and defend it?
But PhDs are great, guys.
Yeah.
PhDs are great. Totally do them.
I should mention, like, I'm being a little, like, dour about it, but, like, I have met a lot of amazing research mentors here and a lot of amazing other grad students that I've learned from both inside and outside of the classroom. So the school I'm at right now has been incredibly supportive and fantastic. So, like, I don't think if I were somewhere else where it was more competitive and people weren't as supportive, I would have dropped out. But the fact that I've had such a good experience here really speaks to the program and the people.
Yeah. A good leap of faith.
Mm. Yes.
Brilliant.
Oh, I got warm and fuzzy over that one, Sarah. Well done. Oh,
nice. Really good. What a good journey we've been on with these flying squirrels and a slight little detour into bumblebees because we couldn't leave them alone, you know, and tonic along the way. So thank you so much, Jeremy. It's been really good.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. It's been a blast.
Thank you. Yeah. I've had a great time. I love flying squirrels. I'm going to go and make pictures all over the place of them.
And imagine them sitting in your hand.
Just little tiny, little one cute.
Sitting in your hand. It would probably bite me, I'm thinking. Do they bite? Mm.
They do bite. And they do bite very hard. Rodents in general don't let up when they bite. So it's not like bite, let go. It's like bite, 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 ow, 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 ow. Like get jaw off of my hand.
From experience.
Yeah. I've been bitten a few times by flying squirrels. Because they want to get, if you're holding them to like, you know, like put the collar on them, they don't want to be grabbed. They want to bite. So you let go of them and they run away. It's a defense mechanism.
Yeah.
Ouch. So no, I think I'll look at them online.
Admire them, but don't touch them.
Yeah, absolutely. I'll leave that for you guys. You can all do that. And if ever I'm in Australia and driving down the highway, I'll be looking for poles for the guiders and just thinking about one way back and trying to find the right pole. Do you imagine if you jumped off the smaller one and then went, no, wrong one? It's not good.
Sarah's brain is just coming up with the whole narrative story. I love it.
So thank you for the tonic too. I really enjoyed trying different tonics. It was a good excuse to try them and still have gin to mix them with, as you would have tonic to mix with your gin. But being able to explore those rather than just pouring in what we would normally do.
Yeah.
Jeremy, thank you for joining us. Really enjoyed flying squirrels. Really enjoyed tonics. Thank you very much.
Yeah. Thank you so much for having me. Like I said, it's been a lot of fun.
Oh, thank you.
flying squirrels, Anya.
Flying squirrels, Sarah.
Little flying squirrels in the palm
not
of your
the
hand.
Not the same as a sugar glider. Not the same.
No. Sugar gliders, marsupials, flying squirrels.
Rodents.
Rodents.
But cute rodents.
Exactly. Cute rodents. And I never thought that groundhog was a squirrel. I wouldn't think of that as a squirrel. And prairie dogs as squirrels. That's feeling a bit weird to me. Finding that a bit strange to connect
but
those.
They probably all love peanut butter.
I should think so.
And they don't love deforestation. No.
No, they don't. But at least people are putting up poles on highways so they can get across, which is pretty cool.
Yeah.
So what have we learned? What have we learned? Why should we research flying squirrels?
Because we don't know enough about their cognitive behaviour.
And by researching, like with researching where they go and how they travel, you can then better manage the space. Mm-hmm. And like with the sugar gliders, even though they're not flying squirrels, that by knowing how much they can glide and what they need to glide, then you can put up things over roads to enable them to move. So that sort of gives us that. And you can see where they poo and how that helps with the ecosystem.
Very important. Very important.
You can have a look at the owl population against the flying squirrel population. You know, there's loads that we can learn, which I find, you know, because you sort of think about an animal and you're like, well, surely once you've learned about it, you've learned about it. But it's all those knock-on things, the fact that it's just a piece in the puzzle. So it's then how does that piece affect the other piece and the other piece? So there's loads still to learn.
There's loads to learn. Yeah.
Which is cool because then Jeremy can find his way back to his love of flying squirrels eventually.
Jeremy, in another 5 years when you've researched some more, we'll see you again. I'm always down for a repeat.
And so that's why should we research them? Why should we protect them? Because same thing.
Yeah.
They're a puzzle. Yeah. A little bit of a puzzle.
Yeah.
Everything is worth it, even little blobfish.
And on that note.
And naked mole rats. Tonics, Anya.
I've enjoyed tonics. I've almost finished my G&T with the fever tree. I'm going to have my Schweppes just as a drink on its own. And I'm going to give the double Dutch away to my friend because I don't want it.
Do you know what? I put the double Dutch in. I'm really enjoying it. But Emma's right. I have no bubbles.
No bubbles.
None.
And all I can think, and I have to say, because it's been in my brain since we talked about bubbles, is the fish from Nemo with my bubbles, my bubbles.
Yeah. And that's disappointing because I've got a good inch or so of a gin and tonic, but I don't because there's no fizz. None at all. It's all gone.
Mine still has fizz. Yeah.
So I will stick with my fever tree. I like my fever tree.
Yeah.
So, good. Flying squirrels, tonics, done.
Nice.
Next week, we better have some gin.
We better have some gin. I'm mind-boggled and I've got an empty glass, and that is gin and topic in a nutshell.
Oh, it is. So it was good, and we will fill that glass for next week. And we will empty our brains, sieve-like, and be ready to learn more next week.
Sarah, before next week, where can everyone find us?
Well, they can find us on social media at Topic Gin, or they can head over to our website at ginandtopic.com, and they can message us, they can, you know, interact with us on that social media type platforming thing. And of course, don't have to wait a whole week.
No.
Because we've got Tuesday Booze Day on Tuesday, introducing the gin, and they can always listen to episodes that they might not have listened to whilst they're waiting.
We've got 6 whole series. You've got 5 to go back and listen to if you haven't already. And we will see you on Tuesday for Tuesday Booze Day.
Nice. Cheers.
Sláinte.